It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's DNR wants to shake up the way it tackles invasive species in the state.
First, as President Obama's second term in office continues, our guest says 5 years in, America's gotten a man who came to the White House with a curiously blank slate, a penchant for magical thinking, and a distaste for confrontation.
The result, according to David Bromwich, a presidency that's never been able to leave the ground.
David Bromwich joins us now. He's Sterling Professor of English at Yale and the author of the piece The Voice, How Obama Became a Publicist for His Presidency Rather Than the President, which ran recently in Tom Dispatch. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, you say that Barack Obama is ruling more like a king than a president. How so?
I mean by that not what some protesters against his presidency would mean. People on the far right, such as the Tea Party, who often refer to him as a tyrant or some sort of absolute monarch. But I mean a king in the sense of someone in a rather weak and ceremonial position in a mixed constitutional government who can make certain decisions completely on his own, does not confer or collaborate with the assembly, with the legislative part of the government, and who sees it as part of his situation to appear often in public, offer glamour by the opportunity of exposure to himself, and to be a sort of ambassador for the spirit of the nation rather than an efficient officer within it. So, you know, the emphasis is on taking the presidency to be a rather a dignified position and not especially an efficient one. That distinction, by the way, comes from a book on the English Constitution by Walter Badgett, a conservative of the mid-19th century, but I think it's just right for application to his case. It somewhat would apply to, I think, the way Ronald Reagan took the presidency as well.
Do you have reason to think that this is how President Obama sees himself, as sort of this magisterial, benevolent monarch rather than someone who is sort of leading the charge?
Yeah, I think it's how he does see himself now, rather consciously so, after the first year in office following his reelection, when he's working against the obstacle of a Republican majority in both houses of Congress, and where his only significant piece of legislation that there was any thought of passage for, which is on immigration, is now pretty well stalled. Nevertheless, he goes around states, from state to state, making speeches about the need for a raise in the minimum wage. He goes on tours of foreign countries, not always very substantive as far as one can see, but this penchant for travel and for exposure of his views domestically as well has been a large part of his presidency from the beginning. I cited in the article you mentioned about Obama wanting to become a certain kind of leader and becoming a different kind, statistics compiled by Mark Noller, the CBS correspondent, about the numbers of small, medium-sized, and large speeches that he had given in the first 4 years of his presidency, his first term, and it's upwards of 1,800. Now, Noller doesn't give any comparative figure on previous presidents, but my bet would be that's a high figure, probably unrivaled in previous presidencies.
Well, and it may be that that has always been part of what has drawn people to Barack Obama, is that he is hyper-articulate. His words have oftentimes soared, and it's the sort of thing that drew especially Democrats to his banner. Yep. Isn't that part of what you would want in a president as well, someone who is well-spoken and who could articulate the message to the people?
You want, I think, someone ideally, and I don't claim to know the name of a candidate or elected person who perfectly fulfilled this. You want someone who can be inspirational, articulate, can have, as you say, an exciting effect through soaring words, but also someone who can explain in an on-the-ground sort of pedestrian way the logic of a policy, and finally someone who can convince members of the legislative branch to go along with him, and whether through persuasive influence or compromise, pass quite a lot of the legislation that he and his party want. As I see Obama, he has that power of inspiring or exciting people. He has it less and less, but he had it in extraordinary measure in 2008 and to a lesser extent in the years following. I think people felt that had reached a definite point of diminishing returns when they were able to compare the 2012 convention speech at the Democratic convention by Bill Clinton with a speech by Obama. And it was remarked by a lot of observers at the time how masterly and, full of momentum and argumentative energy Clinton's speech was, and how rather pale and just typical, characteristic, and boilerplate Obama's speech was. So just talking, when you're doing quite a lot of it, even talking in an inspirational way and speaking words that people want to hear, isn't really enough. And the other trouble with Obama has been the disparity, very visible, between his talk, his words, and his actions.
Yeah, I want to get at that a little bit. Yep. Because you say that, you were talking about his eloquence when he speaks, and that was part of what elected him. He also seemed reasonable. He said he wouldn't play partisan politics. But you say that underneath that, he simply doesn't have strong convictions. So he doesn't have not only the courage of convictions, he doesn't have the convictions themselves. Lay out that case for us.
Well, what is conviction? It's a belief. And under the belief, strong a support for the belief that you would do quite a lot to make it come true. You would even sacrifice some of your popularity. You would even take risks, perhaps even physical risks, certainly political risks. And I think that this sort of political courage, to call it that, is what people have felt was missing in Obama. From early on, I'll mention three instances just from 2009 and two from early 2010. In 2009, he made as one of his first pledges of the presidency the promise to close Guantanamo, and he assigned the White House counsel, Greg Craig, to be in charge of that, a turf war, as they called it, developed between Greg Craig and the chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, which Emanuel won, and the theory was that people aren't interested in closing Guantanamo. And that effort pretty much trailed away, ending in the sacking of Greg Craig, and no more talk about closing Guantanamo. It's a matter of record that Obama himself took almost no interest in any of the details about closing Guantanamo, never pursued the subject. He left it as a sort of commandment, that is to say, words that sound like convictions, and then left it for his people to argue out. The thing trailed off, no action. A second was the promise of his campaign to take care of national security in a way that would not seem to emulate the policies of Dick Cheney. That is to say, massive surveillance and changes in the whole approach to civil liberties that Americans associate with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments to the Bill of Rights. He gave the National Archives speech in May of 2009, following quite a lot of pressure from Cheney particularly, who was active at that moment, and others, saying that Obama, by publishing the records of CIA abuses, he published a first set of them before he suppressed a second set, was endangering the country. That was the speech in which Obama pretty much conceded the substance of Cheney's architecture for national security following 2001, and said that there would, in fact, remain a category of permanent detainees for the length of a war on terror, which, though Obama didn't call it the war on terror, he did call a war. And the policies of secrecy in contest in court cases have invoked much the same state secrets privilege that Bush and Cheney relied on, but to an even greater extent than Bush and Cheney. And then in the end of 2009, after a long examination of the possibilities in Afghanistan, Obama decided to add 33,000 troops to escalate the war there and follow the surge plan in a modified form that was said to have worked in Iraq in 2007. That is to say, he followed the generals Petraeus and McChrystal. He had a good opportunity from supporters such as Doug Lute, who was actually a Bush holdover, from James Cartwright, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was extremely opposed to any escalation in Iraq, from the ambassador from the ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, and from Joe Biden, who was for beginning a pullout right then. But he went the other way. Hillary Clinton sided with the generals, and that made it harder for him. But again, a different kind of president, one might think. And if you want an example, take JFK in his third year. He had an uphill battle against much fiercer military opposition to the Test Ban Treaty, but he pushed it through at considerable risk, taking considerable courage.
And that's part of your case in point here. You say that President Obama does not like to fight. He has a distaste for conflict. We're talking right now with David Bromwich. Bromwich is a professor of English at Yale University and the author of an article that says President Obama became a publicist for his own presidency rather than the president. He says Obama has failed to lead 5 years in. Well, what do you think?
Let us know your thoughts. Is the Obama presidency a disappointment to you? Were there indications for Democrats or critiques from Republicans that troubled you early on and have come into play since then? If you voted for President Obama, did you get what you expected? Has he talked too much, led too little? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're talking with David Bromwich right now. Bromwich is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University. He's the author of a recent article that says President Obama became a publicist for his own presidency rather than the president, that he's failed to lead, and the presidency, in essence, hasn't ever come off the ground. We want to know what you think.
Join in at 800-642-1234. Is the Obama presidency a disappointment to you? Did you vote for him? Did you get what you expected? Or are you saying, I told you so now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or email talk@WPR.org.
And let's go to our callers right now. We have Gene on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just caught the beginning of the program, I guess, and wanted to point out that President Obama, his background is a community organizer, which really means that you do things where all people are working together cooperatively. That's really how he's run his office. That's not what's effective in a corporate, malicious environment that the House has created. But he has done a wonderful job of acting the part of a cooperative person if the House would cooperate.
No, all right.
They haven't.
Well, thank you much for that call and those thoughts, Gene. And David, labor groups, community organizers, environmental groups, these are groups that helped propel Barack Obama into office. What has happened to his relationships with these groups, as you see it, since he came into office?
Well, all of those groups are a good deal more critical of him than they began by being, and all feel that their hopes have been disappointed. He's backing a minimum wage, though not as high as organized labor would like. We're still awaiting his decision on the Keystone XL pipeline, but I think in other respects, the failure of any sort of international treaty on global warming, a failure as pronounced in this administration as it was under Bush and Cheney, has been a tremendous letdown for environmental groups concerned about global warming. And his, as he calls it, all of the above energy policy, which includes sort of ecumenically nuclear power, deep sea drilling, Arctic drilling, fracking, along with the sunshine alternatives, panels for solar energy and wind farms. I mean, it's a very noncommittal. It's the equivalent, if you like, of a bipartisan, nonpartisan stance on energy, but it is too late for that. It's too late for the planet for that. I should say the very idea of being nonpartisan or bipartisan strikes me as a fallacy from the very first. We're in a party system, and Obama was the Democratic candidate. I worked for him. I voted for him twice. I worked for him once. You know, it was the job of the leader of the Democratic Party to take the stand that he fought with, the banner that he carried. But he does think of himself, this is a commonplace now, I think, but it's one of the things I said early on. He thinks of himself as in some ways above politics, and politics as degrading to the kind of job of inspirational unification he sees himself responsible for.
All right, let's go on to another phone call now, and we'll take Gary with us in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi, I was very skeptical about Obama during the election when he got very much a free pass by the mainstream media. And then shortly after his inauguration, he manipulated the Democratic Party away from single-payer health care. And in my opinion, he was installed by the elite to degrade the progressive movement and create problems for the progressives in the Democratic Party. He's often given a winning hand, and he often plays it very badly. So I'm very distrustful. He's more like a Republican than a Democrat.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Gary. And that last comment, David, about getting a winning hand and playing it badly, you talk some about that in your piece. What would you say to that?
Well, I think it's been observed also by others, and I pretty much agree with the drift of that caller, that Obama begins negotiations by conceding everything that he thinks the other side might reasonably ask. So he comes the sort of rational halfway at the beginning because he has a real distaste for bargaining. This goes against most people's idea of what a community organizer is or is trained to do. But in fact, as Obama worked in community organizing, he was considered someone at the extreme of non-confrontational, of wanting to begin every process of negotiation by depolarizing and by bringing the largest powers into the negotiations right at the start. That was much the path he followed in negotiations on affordable health care, and it's been the pattern he's followed elsewhere. So, yeah, I think it is a problem of temperament, and it's a problem of his non-political understanding of politics.
All right, let's try to get one more call in here. John joins us now from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I agree 100%. I did vote for him twice, and I thought he was doing the right thing. I thought he should have spent twice as much on the bailouts than he did, and he didn't, and it got us halfway out of it, like we are. However, when I voted for him the second time around, I was hoping as a lame duck with nothing to lose, he would put more on the line and put it out there and fight. And he's just rolls over, just like you said. He could be doing all sorts of things. He's got nothing to lose. And he's looking to, I guess, get somebody, another Democrat elected. I don't know what he's doing.
All right, John, thanks for your thoughts and thanks for calling in. And David, I want to have you address John's comment, and maybe you could do it through the lens of the way you see his handling of the Affordable Care Act, his signature law, as sort of evidence of what seems to be to you a hands-off approach. What happened?
Well, that seems to me also the key to the fact that Obama looks like the lamest of lame ducks now. In the first 2 years of a second term, which lasts 4 years, you're supposed to be able to do something, perhaps. His hopes for doing anything on immigration and perhaps other matters that are of concern to him, too, including some amelioration of environmental policy, that was harmed very badly by the exposure of the shoddiness of the rollout of the Affordable Care system. He entrusted it to Kathleen Sebelius, and we have it on the record now from a Politico story that I cite in the article, which hasn't been denied by anyone in the White House, that though he met with Sebelius in company a few times, since Obama has very few meetings with his cabinet, he did not meet with her one-on-one a single time in the 3 years between signing that bill and the rollout of the system itself. Now, that's more than hands-off. I think the word that applies most truly to it is dissociation. There is a kind of dissociated quality in the president's relationship to his own policies. Some of the policies are good, and for those of us who believe in those policies, it's even more hurtful that this sort of engagement has been missing all along.
And David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been good to talk to you.
We've been talking to David Bromwich, Sterling Professor of English at Yale University, author of the book Moral Imagination, and we've been talking about his recent piece in Tom Dispatch about Barack Obama.